I think when we interact with our colleagues at committee meetings, when we interact on the national level at national surgical organizations, we want our colleagues to feel empowered and on an equal plane with you, not a one-down plane at all. Again, that's all part of my win-win philosophy.
Hello, this is Zach with the American Journal of Healthcare Strategy. Welcome to the Clinicians and Leadership podcast series, where we focus on empowering clinicians from bedside to boardroom. Today, I am joined by a very esteemed guest with a wealth of experience, both in the clinical component as well as the administrative leadership component of our healthcare industry, and that is Dr. Jay Harness. Dr. Harness, why don't you take a second to introduce yourself and just tell us a little bit about your experience.
Well, okay, Zach. Well, it's a privilege to be with you. I am a University of Michigan, go blue, University of Michigan educated and trained general surgeon by background, who early on in my career morphed into surgical oncology with my initial focus in the world of endocrine surgery. And then for the last 37 years of my practice, was focused pretty exclusively on breast cancer. I had the privilege over the years of rising through the ranks academically at not only the University of Michigan, Tufts University, and the University of California system, but then became involved in the leadership of the American Association of Endocrine Surgeons as its president. The same was true for the American Society of Breast Surgeons and Breast Surgery International. So it's been really my privilege over all these years to be involved, not only clinically, but in a leadership role with national surgical societies. And I think that's what's bringing us here together today.
Yeah. Well, and we could spend the entirety of this episode just talking through your resume, because you have served in a variety of clinical roles. You've served as a professor. You've been a medical director in a variety of organizations. You've founded several organizations. With all your wealth of experience, I'm curious, what have been some of the more impactful experiences that have just developed your approach to leadership?
You know, I got thinking about, I knew about that question from you this morning. I got thinking about, you know, it actually goes back to my pre-med days at the University of Arizona. I was involved in a national fraternity, became vice president in my sophomore year. In my junior year, I became president of the fraternity house, believe it or not. And then in my senior year, president of the Interfraternity Council, very involved in academic and campus politics. And I really think the roots were set there for my subsequent involvement as I grew medically and with the various medical societies that I was involved with. In the 1970s, I was very instrumental in helping to found the intern resident section of the American Medical Association, which is the house staff section today. And, you know, it just sort of kept moving from there. But I think the roots, believe it or not, actually go back to my pre-med education days.
That's awesome. Well, it's like I said before, you have a wealth of experience in clinical side as well as just leadership sides of just not just our healthcare system, but just in general. And it's cool to hear you recognize the benefit of, having served as the medical director, having served on all these committees, having served as consultants and professors, one of the key things that started you on the path that you are was something that wasn't necessarily involved in healthcare in general. And so just recognizing, learning from every opportunity that you have in front of you, that's awesome. And so, like we've mentioned, you've served in a variety of roles and a variety of clinical roles and administrative roles as well. So I'm curious, how has your clinical experience impacted your approach to the administrative and the business and the leadership side of healthcare?
Good question. I still am not sure that I've got a clear answer to that. having been involved in academic medicine for 28 years, academic centers tend to be somewhat political. There were, the joke is there we fight over little things. Out in private practice, which was the last 15 years of my experience, there the fight was simple. It was just about fighting over money. But what you found yourself was that you were in the middle of having to deal with multiple people at multiple levels. And as a surgeon, this is particularly true in the operating room. You know, you may be the surgeon, but you've got assistants, you've got nurses, you've got anesthesiologists, you've got pre-op care, post-op care. So you're constantly interacting with groups of people. My number one paradigm throughout my entire life and career has always been to create a win-win situation. And to be able to carefully listen to what my friends and colleagues are saying so that I could at least meet them halfway, if you will, in negotiations, interactions with them, et cetera. And always, and by doing that, what we're doing, Zach, is that those other people become visible. They don't feel invisible. And that strengthens the bonds as you try and create new things you want to do, become a leader, et cetera, et cetera. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. Yeah. Well, and seeing those people as people and seeing them not making them visible, keeping them from being invisible is just respecting them and showing them that you value them as an individual, like you said, as well as, and that I can't imagine how much that improves the patient experience. If every staff member is understood that they are respected and valued, because each role that an individual serves within a healthcare system is valuable and serves a purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you talk about the patient experience. Obviously, especially I dealt with a lot of vulnerable patients dealing in breast cancer that lasts 35 plus 37 years. So I would walk into the room with a newly diagnosed breast cancer patient, her spouse or family members are there. I'm in a white coat. Hey, they all know I'm a doctor. I don't walk in and, hi, I'm Dr. Harness. No, I walk in, reach out my right hand, look the patient in the eye and say, hi, I'm Jay. I just do the same thing with the family members. I then sit down because I'm 6'1" and a half. Instead of standing up and looking down in the patients, I sit down immediately on the little roll around stool, have the patient up on the table. I'm already delivering a message of empowerment to that patient. And it's the same thing, I think, when we interact with our colleagues at committee meetings, when we interact on the national level at national surgical organizations. We want our colleagues to feel empowered and on an equal plane with you, not a one down plane at all. Again, that's all part of my win-win philosophy.
Something else, Dr. Harness, that I'm curious about is, I mean, we've kind of briefly ran through your resume. We've talked a little bit about some of your experiences. You have quite extensive experience that spans a long time. You've been in the medical field for quite some time successfully. And so, but over the course of those years, the medical field, even now, is changing, and it has changed substantially. So how do you recognize and stay on top of an ever-changing field?
Yeah, well, again, it's the interaction with your colleagues. So here's a good example. Over many years, I ran the multidisciplinary conferences for breast cancer patients. In attendance of those conferences were other medical oncologists, perhaps some other surgical oncologists like myself, radiation oncologists, physical therapists. We were constantly interacting with each other. I was involved in clinical research projects, so I heard about cutting-edge research that was being done. So it was being interactive with my colleagues that helped keep my knowledge base as high as it was. And, you know, we all talk about reading our journals and attending CME conferences and things like that. But I've been privileged to also help teach at those conferences. But again, it's the interaction. And then one of the things I think people forget at these national and international meetings, a lot of information and ideas are exchanged sort of off podium, if you will. In other words, it's part of our mixing and with our colleagues. And I've seen the changes coming early. I saw them at the AMA House of Delegates coming early. I've seen them at other organizations. So keeping our mind open for change and then figuring out how do we adapt to those changes keeps you ahead of the game, Zach. I really believe that.
Yeah. Well, and you touched on this as well, having the humility to know that you're not going to be the smartest person in every room that you go into. And so recognizing that there are other individuals who are doing incredible work and who are leading the front of change and innovation and being able and willing to partner with them and see how they are doing and what they are doing well to better help businesses and the patient care, which is what the medical field is all about.
You know, it's really interesting. Again, I put a fair amount of thought into our interview today prior this morning, and it really hit me as I was thinking about it. I grew up in a family of patent attorneys. My father, his two brothers, and my grandfather, Harness, were all patent attorneys. In fact, the firm founded by my grandfather in 1921 in Detroit is still there. Oh. And so I grew up in an environment of creative thinking. Hey, let me share with you this new invention that somebody's brought to me. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, again, part of my core, that my ability to think openly and creatively. And so as a good example, when we started at the University of Michigan in the mid-80s, one of the very first academic multidisciplinary breast centers, this was at a time, a critical time in the history of breast cancer, where there was a change in our approach to breast cancer. The national trials from both the United States and Italy were published in the early to mid-1980s. And what those trials demonstrated was that we didn't have to do mastectomies in every patient, that you could safely do breast conservation, in layman's terms, lumpectomy plus radiation therapy. And at a faculty meeting, my focus was on the world of endocrine surgery, but the guy running, my colleague, or my chief, I should say, running the faculty meeting said, we want to start a multidisciplinary center where we have the surgeons, the medical oncologists, and the radiation oncologists all in the same clinic at the same time rotating around and seeing those patients to determine if they were candidates for breast conservation. And I sat there and thought, what a brilliant idea. In other words, my mind was open to that. And I kind of quietly put my hand up. Everybody else was, I don't know, counting light bulbs or tying their shoelaces, whatever they were doing. And my chief of general surgery said, all right, Harness, it's your job to get this multidisciplinary breast center up and going. Zach, I had no idea my entire life, my entire career just changed right on the spot. We published, I think to this day, one of the only textbooks on multidisciplinary care. It was called Breast Cancer Collaborative Management. And so that theme of collaborative management still should go on in hospitals today, particularly with hospital administrators, with other colleagues, understand what their issues are, what the problems are, and where do we find that middle win-win ground that everybody thrives on?
I think that is a perfect segue into the next topic that I wanted to discuss. And you've touched on this a number of times just already, but in establishing that multidisciplinary clinic and just other roles that you have served in, specifically more that talking about that multidisciplinary clinic, that you mentioned collaboration, that it requires a lot of collaboration between different individuals with different skill sets and different priorities and different perspectives. Yet all of those different individuals need to come together and unite around a common goal, which is what's going to be best for the patient. And so in your roles in establishing those clinics, how did you approach building that collaboration?
By personal interaction, going to the medical oncologist and say, hey, we really need you, going to the radiation oncologist. And it was a win-win for them. Not only were they discussing possible research projects they were involved with, it also increased patient volume. It increased their interaction with the patients. The same thing was particularly true with social workers that we had involved in our multidisciplinary conferences, because the patients had all sorts of social issues. Same thing for the physical therapists, particularly to look at starting to train patients to help prevent lymphedema, or if they develop lymphedema, get them into treatment right away. The patients loved it. They felt good about the team they were working with, which made the team they were working with feel good about what they were doing. So you see this positive feedback loop, and that's how you build programs.
Something else that I just think is fascinating, just looking at your career and all the accomplishments that you have had, there's been a lot of innovations and changes within the medical field since you started your career at the University of Michigan. And in our previous conversation, we've discussed some of those innovations and that were innovations at the time and now are common medical practices and standards of care. Can you talk about some of those innovations and how you recognize which innovations and opportunities should be pursued?
Yeah, again, it's having an open mind. So I got involved in the 1990s in ultrasound for surgeons. Well, again, it was a quite inadvertent. One of my colleagues walked in and said, hey, Jay, we're doing a course on ultrasound for surgeons at the Southwest Surgical Congress. I'm the vascular surgeon, so I've been doing ultrasound for a long time. I've got my trauma colleague who's been doing the FAST exam with ultrasound in the emergency room. We want you to lecture on ultrasound for the breast. And I said, oh, well, they knew my interest in breast surgery, but I didn't know anything, Zach, about ultrasound other than looking at some images. So I quickly found one of the earliest courses started by industry to teach surgeons how to do ultrasound, took the course, asked their help in creating a lecture, if you will, gave the lecture. The next thing I know, one of the companies who brought equipment there were tapping me on the shoulder and said, hey, Dr. Harness, we'd like you to help teach ultrasound courses out west where you're at. We've got another person doing the same thing back east. Would you do that? And I said, well, sure, but I don't have an ultrasound machine. Well, no problem, we'll get you one. And then I was involved in the earliest days of the creation of the American Society of Breast Surgeons. And suddenly I found a few other breast surgeons who were interested in this. The next thing you know, we started doing courses at the American Society for Breast Surgeons on ultrasound for breast surgeons. And what we found was that we were natural sonographers. In other words, once we got over the intimidation of the knobs on the machine and learned how the piezoelectric effect created images and learned how to hold the transducer and do it right, we were like ducks on the water. We would just take right off with that and apply the use of that technology in other areas. So my second book was actually a book on ultrasound in surgical practice. And the rest of its history, ultrasound now used by general surgeons or by breast surgeons and general surgeons is so very, very common. So that's that same process, Zach, of being open to new ideas, learning about them, getting excited about them, having passion about them, and then teaching our colleagues. Another way of putting this is I've always been an early adopter. And one of my favorite people out there is Simon Sinek. And I think I shared this with you before. This is Simon Sinek's book, Start With Why. You remember that?
Sure.
And Simon talks about the golden circle. And here's the golden circle. And on the inner circle is the why. In other words, what's the purpose or belief or the new thing we're learning? The next circle out is the how do we do that? And then thirdly is the what. what are we actually delivering out there? And Simon talks about people who understand a why of something become the early adopters. The early adopters, those numbers then slowly grow until there's a tsunami effect when all of a sudden the crowd joins us at that point and says, wow, this is really great. Thank you very much. But anyway, I'm an early adopter. I get things early and I get passionate about things.
Well, and it's wild to just think about all the different ways that, ultrasound is such common practice and standard of care now. And it's fascinating to think back that, hey, all of our, the innovations that are now, the former innovations that are now standard of care and common practice were at one point innovations that required early adopters as yourself and clinicians that recognize the value of them.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's having an open mind to get when something's new and that it can really have applicability, whether it's an organization of how we deliver care, it's a new procedure, it's a new whatever. You've got to have an open mind and a willingness to be an early adopter.
So I'm a little curious, how do you approach, I reckon, you know, having the open mind is critical. There's a lot of opportunities out there. So how do you approach distinguishing which opportunities to pursue and which ones not to pursue?
Well, I had to give a talk recently when I was receiving a national award for my career. And the theme of the talk was a life beautifully orchestrated. As things come along, are we open to them and then pursue those pathways? And I think it's been sort of my approach to life to listen to the music of life. And when that music sounds right, play it, if you will. And for me, at least, it's led to a wonderful and beautifully orchestrated life and career.
Something else, Dr. Harness, that I'm curious just to hear your thoughts on is having been the early adopter for a number of different things, you have a unique perspective on what it takes to get those innovations to become standards of care and common practices. And that is not without some barriers and some hurdles and mountains to climb. And so what are some common barriers to innovation and how do you approach navigating those barriers?
Yeah, my current world is the world of exercise oncology, which I was just lecturing at the American College of Surgeons meeting recently and asked the audience in a small class that I was running of 100 people or so, how many of you have ever heard the term exercise oncology? Raise a hand. Not a single hand went up. So I realized that they were not aware of the science that had been developed over the last 25 years by PhD researchers. So the answer, Zach, to your question, I think in our world of medicine are typically two things. One, information and knowledge. And that requires educating people about information we may not be aware of. So again, 25, 30 years of outstanding clinical trials showing the benefits of exercising cancer patients prehab during their active treatment and long-term survivorship. Virtually none of that literature had crossed over to the allopathic, osteopathic practices of medicine in the fields of oncology. But yet the other reality and devices and new procedures and whatever is frankly reimbursement. And that's a long road to haul. And it takes a small little mini army of dedicated people with lots of data to take on CMS and go after a national coverage determination to get the codes that we need. So none of these have occurred, like ultrasound as an example, or nipple-sparing mastectomy that I've been involved with for 12 years or more. These don't occur overnight, but what they take is a dedicated group of people willing to believe in whatever it is we're working on and to work our way forward until we reach the conclusions we're all after. Again, those win-win conclusions, where not only the benefits are to the patients, but to the industry that we're so proud to be part of.
Well, and you just highlight the importance of having clinicians in leadership. So you have individuals with the perspective of being able to recognize the science, as well as the approach to receiving that reimbursement. You need individuals with both perspectives so that they can fight and advocate for innovations that need to be implemented.
Well, and you've really nailed it with that statement, because that's particularly true right now. As medical practices are being purchased and there's greater and greater consolidation, actually the need for physician leadership is actually some of the greatest it's ever been now, so that our voices are heard. We are, in fact, the primary advocates for the patients. And as medicine becomes more and more corporate, we have got to be strong, holding together, and very vocal to protect not only our practices and doing what we know is right, but protecting our patients.
And that is part of the reason why we are having this conversation today, is to hear from an individual like yourself who has successfully advocated for patients for years over the course of their career and the variety of roles that you had.
Yeah, when I gave this award talk recently, one of my initial slides showed a guy walking down the road with arrows sticking out of his back. I felt that a lot of my career, people have got their bows out and been shooting at me. But you know what? You just got to take the arrows in the back and keep on going forward.
So, Dr. Harness, as we come to a close, I'm curious, what are some opportunities that you're pursuing right now? You've done a lot over the course of the career. You mentioned some new positions and roles that you're filling. I'm curious, what are you up to nowadays?
Yeah, well, I have to maintain passion. If you're familiar with the Blue Zone communities, one of the key things of people living well into their 90s is not only social structure, diet, exercise, and others, but it's also having passion. And I'm passionately involved in exercise oncology. It's really interesting, in Australia, they've already adopted exercise oncology programs as a standard of adjunctive care for all cancer patients, because the science is so strong. We're hoping to see the same thing happen here in the United States and globally. And I'm having a great time as a physician, helping to lead that charge and to maintain my passion, not only for medicine, for my patients, but for life.
Well, Dr. Harness, we thank you for your insights, and just it fascinating. I benefited greatly from getting to hear about your experience and the conversation that we had previously, as well as this interview today. So thank you, sir, for joining us today on the Clinicians and Leadership podcast series. And we wish you the best. We're rooting for you.
Well, thank you, sir. And it's been my absolute privilege to be with you, Zach. All the best, my friend.
Take care.